Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have here as the guest in this first hour of Focus 580, our own meteorologist, Ed Keezer. And we're going to be talking about winter weather. Here over the next couple of days, we're going to be enjoying some mild temperatures, mild weather, sort of on the warmer side of the average. But you know, one of these days it is going to be winter, and in fact, this is the week that's been set aside both in Illinois and Indiana to encourage people to think about preparing for winter weather. The two states call it something different, but essentially it's the same idea, that people ought to be thinking about the fact that winter storms can sometimes cause problems, and it's good to think about that and to think about what you would do if you got, particularly if you got stuck, maybe if you got snowed in, if that's a possibility, or maybe if you were out in the countryside, you were driving and you got stuck in your car, what exactly you would do. This morning, we will talk a little bit about winter weather and how it works. And if people who are listening have questions, I know Ed will do his best to answer. I just want to make sure people understand where this is not like Fridays. This is not talk to Ed. Save your questions if you're going to be traveling. We'll do that usual thing on Friday. But what we do here occasionally when he's on the program in the longer format show, this is an opportunity for people to ask questions that were a little bit more involved. So if you have questions about the weather and how it works and about forecasting, those are the kinds of things we can do here on the show. And I know Ed will do his best to answer your question. If you want to call us, that's great, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And here locally, 333-9455. Well, thanks very much.
Good morning.
For being here. It is a good thing to remind people that that winter storms can be a problem. Now, I guess if you look at the various kinds of severe weather and the kinds of damage that it can cause, particularly if we're talking about loss of life, I think that that flooding is actually number one. Is that?
Well, if you're talking, it depends on the definition. It's like any statistic. Actually, probably weather-related, the biggest killer would be a heat wave, but then cold winter storms overall are the larger scale things. But from just when I talk about winter storm, I'm talking about the cold waves that follow as well. When you talk about storm-related deaths, you are correct. Flooding is number one.
So that's one of the things that, particularly in the summertime, when there's a possibility of flooding, we always try to mention that to people. That particularly a lot of people are injured or killed because they're in vehicles and they try to drive across areas that are flooded, and they think, "Oh, no problem here. I can go right across." And in fact, that causes a real problem. But that's maybe we should say that's another season's worth.
That's true. But flooding is number one, and then you have lightning, then tornadoes. Mm-hmm. Tornadoes are, well, they get the most attention because those are very violent storms. More people are killed by lightning and flooding each year. And then, of course, we have our winter storms and summer heat waves, too, which are of a larger scale and last longer. And, of course, winter storms are what we're focusing in on now because we're getting to that season.
And it's also the kind of thing that maybe we're not quite as aware of. We don't think about the potential for causing problems. Some in winter storms, I think, because they move slowly and we have a fair amount of warning. It's not like with severe storms in the spring and the summer that a storm could pop up. You know, the weather service might say, within this area, and sometimes it could be a large geographic area, they'd say, within this area, we think there is a possibility of severe weather. And then it could pop up one place, and in the other parts of that area, it could be just fine. You know, nothing could be going on. So it can jump on you really quick. And I think one of the big differences between that and winter severe weather is that, generally speaking, we do get more notice and that the storms move a little bit more slowly.
That's true. They don't pop up as much. There are still some forecasting, I guess you could say, tricks for a forecaster. There are little subtleties that make a big difference one way or the other, but the main winter storm is still a much bigger thing. You know it's coming, but sometimes you're on that edge between 34 degrees and 31 degrees, not only at the ground, but up a couple thousand feet in the atmosphere. And just a little change in a storm track can make all the difference between rain or an ice storm or a snowstorm. And, of course, with Illinois and Indiana, both are states that are very long north to south. Mm-hmm. You usually, with a major winter storm, get all types of precipitation within our two-state area and within our listening area. So there are forecasting challenges in the winter. They're just different from the summer pop-up challenges.
Yeah. We generally try to do these kinds of programs. We do them in the winter, or about this time of year, to kind of look forward to the winter. And also then in the springtime, in the early spring or late winter, when it's Tornado Awareness Week. And I probably always ask this sort of the same question. The two kinds of weather and the two kinds of storms seem to work a little bit differently. And what we just talked about, the fact that in the winter, the storms, maybe they are bigger, but they're slower moving. You get more notice. I mean, what's happening in the dynamics of the atmosphere that affects the weather that makes the big difference between what generally winter storms are like and what spring and the early summer storms are like, where you can get the possibility of really severe thunderstorms and then tornadoes?
Well, actually, in some ways, there are some similarities in the big picture. The big difference is just the main jet stream, the fast-moving river of air up about 8 miles above our heads that meanders from west to east across the North American continent, moves farther south in winter because the dividing line between cold to the north and warm to the south is farther south. So we get more on the winter side of things. But believe it or not, when we have our big tornado outbreaks, there's usually a big cyclone or low pressure center moving across the middle part of the country, similar to those that produce our wintry weather. We're just on the warm side of it as opposed to the cold side. Mm-hmm. And coming up this weekend, we may have a situation where there is a blizzard in the upper Midwest Sunday into Monday. Well, farther south, there could be tornadoes and severe thunderstorms, and it's all part of the big package of a major low pressure system moving from southwest to northeast through the Midwest. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about forecasting severe storms, as you mentioned, with the pop-up nature of thunderstorms and the small size, thunderstorms are on a smaller scale, but they occur due to larger scale atmospheric dynamics, which are associated with a more powerful low-pressure system or cyclone, what we like to call a middle-latitude cyclonic storm. And so sometimes when we're having a blizzard well down south, they're getting the tornadoes and severe thunderstorms that we often see in the spring and early summer.
Hmm. So if people, as they sometimes watch people, if they watch weather on television, you'll see the weather maps, and you see the fronts, and then you see the lows and the highs. So your big L's and H's. And I guess if people can remember anything about the L's and the H's, is that the wind circulates around them in different ways. The wind circulates around the high in a clockwise way and around the low in the counterclockwise way.
Correct.
So if you're thinking about lows, for example, and if it's going counterclockwise, then if you're on one side, it's going to be probably going to be scooping up warmer and possibly moister air from the south and bringing it up your way. But if you're on the other side, it's going to be doing the opposite thing. It's going to be bringing the cold air from the north down around the back side. So there's a difference in the winter and the summer generally for us, where the lows go?
Yeah, in part. That's part of it. Now, sometimes in the winter when we have our warm days where it gets into the 50s, you know, we're on the warm side of the low and we're not necessarily getting tornadoes because there are some other factors that go into making a thunderstorm that produces tornadoes, and part of it is the atmosphere has to be unstable enough, and solar heating helps do that, and you don't have much solar heating in the middle of winter. Mm-hmm. It's not to say you can't occasionally get a tornado. We've had them in our two-state area in every month of the year. They're just more frequent once the days get longer and the sun gets higher in the sky, but when you're on the southeast side of a big low or L on the weather map, you're on the warm side. And when you're on the northwest side, you're on the cold side. And that's where the heavy precipitation and the snow and ice occurs and blizzard conditions. So it does come down to how does that low track in relation to where you are. If the low travels up the Ohio Valley, we're on the cold side.
Hmm.
We get the winter weather. If it tracks up through Iowa into Wisconsin, we're on the warm side.
If you have questions about winter weather, that's what we're talking about here this morning. The guest is our meteorologist, Ed Kieser, for WYLL AM FM TV. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We do have a couple callers here in El Paso to start out, Illinois, line number one right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah. Hi.
I enjoy your all the information you give us daily about weather. It's as accurate as anybody's, and I enjoy that. You were talking about like winter preparedness. I had a couple ideas of things that folks ought to always carry in their car that you may not think about right away, but they're really handy. These little tarps, they usually come in blue, but they're, you know, you can get a 5x7 tarp for something like a little over $1 at hardware stores or Walmart or some places. And it's always good to have even a couple of those in the car. Like when I have to change a tire, I got to get down on my hands and knees or lay down to get a jack under the thing, and they'll protect your clothes and keep you dry. And the other thing that is always handy to have is a small plastic pail, even like a gallon ice cream bucket or something to keep in a trunk to either catch some water if you need it for something, or even if you change a tire to put the lug bolts in it or something while you're working. So those are just a couple of things folks may not think about that are handy to have and don't take up too much room.
Well, those are things that aren't on a lot of the official list, but that is a good idea. And the one thing you mentioned about the tarp, it is very important to stay dry in winter storms, but you don't want to have wet clothes, obviously, when it's really cold out, because that just helps the loss of body heat, and it just keeping dry is very important.
Yeah, you know, and also folks in a storm, they should not leave their vehicle unless they are absolutely sure where they're going and it's a very short distance. My wife got caught in a ditch just less than a quarter mile from our home a couple years ago, and coming home from work one evening, and by the time she walked up to our home, she looked like a snow girl. She was just covered, and you know, you just can't walk very far in that weather.
Well, it is advised when there is a blizzard type condition and you get stranded and you can't see where you're going to stay with your vehicle, because it is very easy to get disoriented, especially in the outlying areas where there's no buildings at all. You could just end up in the middle of a field somewhere, and you think you're going one direction, and you turn along the way, and you could end up going in circles, and then you're away from your car, which can keep you warm, and you're away from all buildings. And if you're stranded in your car in a blizzard, it's good to stay with the car if you can't see a building nearby to go to.
Well, thank you for the good program.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Bye.
We have another caller here, and Len, this person is in, let me see, in Eureka, and on line number four. That's right. Okay. In line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. We're getting people from Northwest here, El Paso and Eureka.
Well, it's kind of a seasonal inquiry.
Okay.
The first of the week, you probably heard how up in Chicago the planes were delayed a couple of hours each morning, the early part of the week. But I want to bring it on down here to near Eureka. We had fog around here at the same time, but this happened one evening, early evening. Well, I had to drive over to Peoria, which is near the Illinois River. And when I got within 2 or 3 miles of the river, and then Peoria wasn't fogged in. It was fogged in up here around Eureka, but it wasn't fogged in down around Peoria. And why would we have it up here but not there?
Well, with fog, it depends on, sometimes it could be the reverse, where Peoria would have fog and you might not. It just depends on how the fog forms. And the fog that we had earlier this week was rather widespread over most of the area, so there might have been some areas that had a little less, such as Peoria. And basically, to get fog, the air has to be near saturation, the relative humidity near 100% near the ground, and Also, you don't usually have strong winds to mix things up quite a bit. So if the winds are relatively light and the air is saturated, you can get fog. And the way to do that usually is to have the air cool in some way, or you bring moisture in. In the case of earlier this week, we had southerly winds bringing in higher dew point air, higher humidity. And with the temperatures cool at night, the fog just formed with the temperature getting down to the dew point. It just may be a case of where you're located was just a little bit cooler than Peoria at that time, and that could make all the difference, a few degrees in temperature. Sometimes it can be the other way, where you could have what we call steam fog, and the Illinois River could be a producer of fog. That's more common in the middle of winter before it freezes up, where water evaporates into cold air, and there again you have the air saturated rather quickly and you get fog. So there's different types of fog. There's what we call radiation fog, and that's just when you have radiational cooling on a clear, calm night. The temperature could cool down to the dew point. That makes the air saturated, and you then start to have the condensation, which is the making of the fog. Fog is nothing more than a cloud on the ground. You can have that evaporation or mixing fog over lakes and streams when it's cold out especially. And again, the wind's nearly calm. And there's also another type of fog called advection fog, and that's fog that blows in from somewhere else and often is produced in our part of the country in the wintertime when moist air from the Gulf of Mexico passes over the cold snowpack that would be over us when we have a snow cover. So that means the temperature drops to the dew point, which is higher with the moist air coming in, and you get fog that way. So there's many different ways in which fog can be produced around here. And I would just say that what you observed was probably Peoria was the exception rather than the rule at that time, because there was a lot of fog across the Midwest.
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, I hope that helps. Let's go to line number one next for a caller in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Ed. Thanks for being on the show.
It's good to be here.
I've got three questions that are all related to each other. I can probably just ask them all at the same time.
If I can remember the last. Go ahead, we'll try it out.
Okay, the first one is, given that we have had such a nice, balmy fall and winter here so far, what are your long-term predictions for the rest of the winter? Would you expect it to be warm still? And specifically, if you do think it's going to be warm, what do you think that would... Do you think global warming would be involved in that at all? And thirdly, if I were interested in looking that up myself, researching it on the internet or something, like weather models and forecasts for the winter, do you know of any websites or other sources I could go to?
Okay, well, I'll comment on all of that. First off, as far as making a winter forecast as a meteorologist, I don't tend to do that because once you get more than a couple weeks out, the forecasting accuracy really goes down. The National Weather Service puts out a outlook for winter every year. They have one out on the internet at http://. Most people don't need all that part. But NOAA News, one word, .noaa.gov/stories2003.
Did you say stories?
Stories, yeah. Stories 2003, that's all together. STORIES 2003 / S2100, I don't know what that means, .htm. Probably if you went to any National Weather Service site, you could also surf to find it. But a winter outlook has been posted, and basically what you might expect is they don't tell you much anything. They give an equal chances for temperature and precipitation being above, near, or below average across most of the country. I think there's a bias toward a little wetter than average down around the Texas-Oklahoma area. And
yeah, here's I've got it for here.
And
here it is.
David's looking at it here. And for Texas on into the southwestern U.S., especially South Texas into the southwest U.S., there's a little bit higher tilt in the odds toward warmer than average this winter. But their outlook says nothing conclusive. Basically, as a forecaster, I know you can't really usually have anything conclusive out in time, so their outlook just tilts the odds a little bit one way or another. And usually for this part of the country, there are no good indicators ahead of time, including the weather that we are currently having. The only correlation to a long-range outlook for Illinois, Indiana, that I've seen is that if you have what we call a strong El Nino in the Pacific Ocean, and it's not just any El Nino, it's a strong one. We tend to be warmer than average for winter, and we have about half as much snowfall. Outside of a strong El Nino, I haven't seen any good correlations of any one particular thing to what kind of winter we're going to have around here. It's really just flipping a three-sided coin, I guess, between above, near, and below average. And I can say there are some longer scale cycles that occur that scientists are studying. One is called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which lasts for 1 to 2 decades at a time. And we've now gone to what's called the negative phase. And that would mean that winters would tend to be a little cooler and snowier than when it's in the positive phase, which we had during most of the 1990s. That's not to say that any individual winter will, that you could forecast any individual winter based on that, because we have had a couple mild winters even with that. But we've also had a couple winters in recent years that have been a bit colder and snowier than what we were tending to have most of the late 90s. So it's a long answer here, but basically I don't have a forecast for the winter other than to say I think the odds are that we'll have a more traditional winter than, say, maybe 5 years ago when we were tending to run warmer than average. As far as global warming goes, I'm not an expert on that. I can tell you that the first thing to think about with global warming is we're talking about the globe, and we're talking about the heating up of the global average temperature slowly, but that can have a big impact on a lot of things. But you're looking at a global average temperature, and that still doesn't explain the ups and downs that occur from year to year and month to month in different portions of the world. Even if the global average temperature goes up dramatically, and when I say dramatically, 5 degrees Celsius over the next few decades, if it were to do that, we would still have periods of cold weather. It wouldn't be all of a sudden warm all the time. You might have a tendency more toward a longer growing season and not as long a period of cold weather, but you still could have those really cold, snowy winters. And in fact, some have stated that storms will be more extreme, including winter storms, with global warming. But that's about all I want to say on global warming, because that is not my area of expertise.
Okay, I can ask you one more bonus question if you'd like.
Sure.
It's optional, and I'll hang up and listen after I ask. Given that water is heavier than air, why do clouds float in the sky? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, why do clouds float in the sky? Well, actually, water in the gas form weighs less than the rest of the regular air, because the atmosphere is made up, the lower atmosphere is made up primarily of nitrogen and oxygen, and they have molecular weights that are higher than H2O. Now, clouds, when they form, they form with just millions of really tiny little cloud droplets and ice crystals. And they do tend to fall through the cloud, but they're very, very small, and usually they get to a point where they evaporate on their way down. So there might be some, I don't know, if you were to really study it, you might see falling particles in the clouds, but the cloud maintains its location where you have the air is saturated and you have condensation taking place. But what's really happening is you have a lot of, in the say that it's a liquid cloud, not ice crystals, you have a lot of droplets forming at that layer of saturation, and they may fall and evaporate, but new ones form, so you end up seeing the cloud right where it is. And that's something to think about. Another one thing people often think is you need the relative humidity 100% or saturated air to get rain, and that's not true. You just need the air saturated up at the cloud level where the rain forms. And in fact, if raindrops fall into a dry atmosphere, a lot of them do evaporate on the way down. So a lot of times we'll see in the winter, especially with a dry atmosphere, you'll see a lot of returns on the radar with nothing reaching the ground because a lot of it's evaporating on the way down.
Okay. We are about midway already through this hour, Focus 580. Our guest is Ed Kieser. He's our own meteorologist here at WILL AM FM TV. We're talking about winter weather and how it works, and if you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And just for what it's worth, in the way of weather trivia, I got some information here. I guess this must have come off of from the Weather Service, that the coldest temperature ever recorded in the state of Illinois happened on January 5th of 1999. So that was recent.
I remember that.
Remember that? This was in Congerville.
Yep.
And they recorded a temperature of minus 36. Now, I also kind of wonder about that, but
that was certified.
It was certified. Okay,
The water survey had a low temperature of 25 below zero. Congerville is in a river valley, and cold air tends to collect in valleys on a clear, calm morning. And to get temperatures down at those levels around here, to those all-time record levels, you need a generally clear, calm atmosphere and a nice, thick snow cover. And you may recall, starting on New Year's Day of 1999, it started snowing, lasting into the second, and that was actually the biggest snowfall in Champaign-Urbana on record, 15 inches.
Really, that same?
That snowstorm, yeah. So there was a rather large snowfall a couple days preceding that, and that led to that cold temperature reading. And we had temperatures in the 20s below zero common on that morning of January 5th, 1999.
All right. Well, let's talk with some other folks. And I think next caller is over in Indiana, Oaktown, Indiana, line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have a suggestion and a comment, too. On my winter kit I put in my car, I always keep insulated coveralls, and then I used to carry a cat litter, you know, in case you got stuck.
Mm-hmm.
But now I just buy the cheapest and driest cat food or dog food I can get, and you can put that down and help you get out of a slick spot, and then whenever it thaws out, the birds will eat that.
Well, that's pretty good. Works two ways there.
Yeah, I have a real steep driveway, and I have to open up my door and then back up and get a run at it, or otherwise I can't make it. So, and the birds always come and eat it up. So,
well, that's very good suggestions.
You know, excuse me. If you're, you know, like parked on a street with a lot of crown, you know, and parked against the curb, just mm-hmm. a little thing like that, that'll help out.
Yeah, well, that's great.
And the observation is, well, I live just about halfway between Terre Haute and Evansville, and the guy on TV in Terre Haute tells us all our major storms, winter storms, originate in the Oklahoma-Texas panhandle. And the observation I made in the summertime, or not summertime, but springtime, here locally on the other side of Knox County, the little town of Petersburg, just continuously, almost every 5 years, get hit by tornadoes. I mean, they get hit real bad. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, I do think that first off, the major winter storms that would affect your area, the low pressure system does originate. Usually, southeast Colorado is a favored spot for low pressure development, and then they kind of move down into that Oklahoma, Texas panhandle area, and then come up from southwest to northeast. So that is a preferred storm track to produce wintry weather around here. Now, as far as tornadoes go, I do know that that there, from time to time, are outbreaks of tornadoes in your area. And I do recall Petersburg, in particular, on June 2nd of 1990, got hard hit. That was part of the largest tornado outbreak in Indiana history in terms of number of tornadoes, and the worst one of the day was in Petersburg. A lot of times, I don't think there's any town that's favored over any other. It's just that when a town gets hit, you hear about it more. There's probably other tornadoes that, if you were to map out all tornadoes, there might be some regional area that gets a little more down there due to the topography, but by and large, you'd probably see the distribution a little more spread out than you think, because I know up here in Champaign County, you know, people will say that Sadorus gets hit all the time, when in fact sometimes the tornado might be 2 miles north of Sadorus or a few miles south, and that's just the biggest landmark in that part of the county. So people will just attach Sadorus to it. And of course, in 1976, Sadorus got hit, the southern part of that town, head on. So as far as the Petersburg phenomenon, you know, they did get hit big in 1990. They've had some other tornadoes hit them, but they're also more newsworthy than maybe some others that occur just in the countryside.
I was just thinking about, you know, storm track angle of the whole deal. I'm not saying Petersburg's got a bunch of evil people in it.
No. You know? No, but there are perceptions. I get that, too. Probably one of the biggest perceptions in this part of the country is everything takes a certain track. And I know with a lot of farmers, the track is always north or south of the farm, too. But it's one of those things that if you could statistically measure it over time, things do balance out more than I think a lot of people think.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thanks for your call and suggestions and observations.
All right, let's go. We'll talk to someone next in Belgium. Line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm not sure if we're going to get an answer on this one, but we're going to talk about it. I notice all the time that weathermen always talk about the change of times. You know, while they're giving the weather report, they say tonight's the night to change from daylight savings to day, you know, standard time. And I have this young niece who stays with me a lot, and she's a sixth grader, and she's kind of inquisitive. And she says, well, what happens at Antarctica? And I said, well, I don't know what time it is at Antarctica, because we're either pole, and does one pole have the same time as the other pole? So I would like to ask that question.
Well, you know, that's a good question, because basically the time zones are roughly mapped out so that you have the middle part of the day occurring close to noon. And, of course, the time changing that we talk about twice a year with the change to daylight saving time, that's just artificially moving the day an hour to get a little more light in the evening. Of course, much of Indiana doesn't do that and stays on standard time all year round. But each time zone is approximately 15 degrees of longitude wide, because there's 360 degrees of longitude going around the world, starting with the prime meridian at Greenwich, England, and going over to the other side of the world, 180 degrees longitude would be roughly the international dateline. So if you take 360 and divide it by 24 hours, you get 15 degrees of longitude for each time zone. Of course, then politics get involved and those lines get very wiggly, and there are even a few places in the world where the time zone is on the half hour. I think parts of Newfoundland and Canada are off by a half an hour. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the North Pole, nobody lives there, so the time that would be in effect at the North Pole would be what we call now Coordinated Universal Time. It used to be called Greenwich Mean Time, and that would be the standard time going through Greenwich, England, or along the Prime Meridian. And for us right now, it's 10:40 a.m. Central Standard Time, 11:40 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and in Greenwich time, it would be 16:40 or 4:40 p.m., and that would be the time that they would use at the North Pole, and I would guess that that's the time they use at the South Pole, but I honestly don't know for sure. Because people do live at the South Pole.
Now, wouldn't it be, since the tilt of the Earth, you might want to be at the actual opposite, so it would be midnight at the South Pole and noon at the North Pole?
No, because all the lines of longitude converge at both poles. So really, when you if you stand at the South Pole and you take a step in any direction, you're going north.
Well, I understand
that and all of that. And, well, what happens is, too, they don't have a midnight and a noon really at either place, because right now the South Pole is light 24 hours a day and the North Pole is dark 24 hours a day because of the tilt of the Earth. So at those two places, you just have 1 6-month day and 1 6-month night. So for time purposes, I would venture to guess they use just the coordinated universal time, because they don't really have a middle part of the day or middle part of the night. It's very interesting at those places. It's hard to almost conceptualize, but that's what happens there. So the North Pole, they're going to be dark here until about March 20th, and then they'll be light from March 20th until September 22nd.
Thank you very much.
I hope that helps, and I'm glad that your niece is very inquisitive. That's good to hear.
All right. We need inquisitive young people. About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus with our meteorologist, Ed Kieser. We have talked about a lot of different things, but the idea basically of the show is to talk a little bit about winter weather. This is the week that has been set aside both in Illinois and Indiana to encourage people to think about, get ready for the fact that it's going to get cold, and we're going to have snow, and we're going to have to deal with that for a few months. It's a winter weather preparedness week, and questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Our next caller is in Urbana, line 3.
Hi, my name is Theo Hunt, and just have a question about ice storm conditions. I wonder why it's not rain or snow, but ice, and why it forms.
Okay. Well, first of all, to get an ice storm, conditions in the atmosphere, not only at the ground but going up a few miles, have to be just exactly so temperature-wise to get ice. And really, ice comes from what we call freezing rain, and freezing rain is just rain that falls, and when it hits the ground is below freezing. But the layer of the atmosphere, from a few hundred feet above the ground to probably a few thousand feet above the ground is above freezing. Most winter precipitation falling out of a cloud starts out as a snowflake of some type, because in the middle of winter, it's cold enough at the cloud level, you just have snowflakes coming down. But a lot of times, as you get closer to the ground, within the lowest couple of miles, you'll get a layer in which the temperature is above freezing, so those snowflakes will then melt. And then if it's above freezing all the way to the ground, then you have a raindrop. If there's a significant layer of below freezing air from the ground on up, say about a half a mile or a little more, then those raindrops will refreeze, and then you get ice pellets, which is the official term for sleet. But if you have a significant layer that's above freezing, but then right near the ground it's below freezing, then the rain drops make it all the way to the ground. They don't have a chance to freeze up, so you have technically what we call supercooled drops. That is, liquid drops that exist in an atmosphere that's below freezing. And when those supercooled drops hit anything at the ground that's below freezing, it just freezes instantly onto the objects, be it a roadway, a power line, or a tree limb. And that's, if that those conditions occur for several hours, you start to get an accumulation of ice, and that's what we call an ice storm. And because you need those conditions to maintain themselves or to maintain over several hours, ice storms are I won't say rare, because they occur every winter, but to get an ice storm of great significance at a particular location in a given year is rather rare. We usually see freezing rain a few times a year, but it usually doesn't last long. And about every 10 to 12 years, we get the big ice storm around here, which causes great havoc for travel and for power distribution. And radio and TV stations are sensitive, too, because sometimes the weight of the ice collapses the towers from which we send our signals out, and it's a big mess when we get an ice storm. And the last really big one around here was on Valentine's Day, 1990. Last year on Valentine's Day, we came very, very close. As I recall, the temperature stayed just above freezing at the ground level most of the time that we had precipitation. And had it been about 2 degrees colder, we would have had a big, big mess.
Ah, yes, we all remember that. We all remember that Valentine's Day storm. That was quite the deal.
The 1990 one.
That one in 1990.
Well, I'll tell you, I remember the one last year because it looked like we had a good shot at the temperature being about 30 or 31 at the ground, and fortunately it was sitting around 33, 34, and I caught a lot of grief for the ice storm that didn't happen. But, you know, it would have been a lot worse if I had said, oh, everything's okay, and then we got the ice storm.
Well, I'm sure anybody who lived through that ice storm before would be happy that it did not happen again.
That is the trickiest part of forecasting. And usually, if it just misses here, it happens somewhere else. And again, if it goes right along the – usually, you get a band of ice from west, southwest, east, northeast. So if it's along the – what we call I-72 corridor, you get Springfield, Decatur, Champaign, Urbana, Danville. If it happens there – then it's big news, and you've got a huge mess. But if it goes 30 miles north, that's going to hit some people that listen to us, but it's not going to make the big news if it's not in the big, big urban centers.
Okay. Let's talk with some more folks down in southern Illinois. Line one. Hello.
Yes. Mr. Kisser, I want to congratulate you. You do a tremendous job. No tell how many times people do not travel because of your forecasting that the snow or things like that. So that's great. That's wonderful. And many times you do not know the answer and you say so. I like that.
I think that's important too because a lot of places, I know everybody listening wants an answer all the time, and sometimes I'm very confident in my answers and sometimes I'm not. And I think that because that's just the nature of meteorology and forecasting the weather. And I think it's important to give the degree of uncertainty as well as the actual forecast. So I appreciate hearing that comment.
Well, you know, it's understandable. And any profession which yours is a profession, and I know people study a lot for that. And any profession, sometimes you just don't know the answer. And it's good to say, you have to be confident to say, I don't know. And that I appreciate on you. One thing I wanted to ask you, I'm from South America, how come you concentrate on Argentina? And there are two little words.
Oh, I'm sure. I don't pronounce everything perfectly down there, I know, but I'll let you give me those words. I'll tell you, first of all, the reason we concentrated on is a lot of corn and soybeans are grown in Argentina and Brazil, and those affect the corn and soybean commodity prices, which affects the largest industry in our area, agriculture, and we have a lot of listeners that need to make decisions, and that's partly why that's on there. And we focus on that during our winter, their summer. So what are the words?
Those two little words, you have corrected one, which is Cordova. Cordova, you used to say Cordova, but you have corrected it. And I'm so glad. But there is another one that you still have not corrected.
Okay.
La Pampa. La Pampa. P-A-M-P-A.
Uh-huh.
La Pampa is the area where the cattle is raised.
Uh-huh.
And it's La Pampa.
What do I say?
And there is somebody else in your radio station that also says it. I believe the other one says it worse than you do, because you say it pretty close. The other person said La Pampa. La Pampa, I think he says. But it's La Pampa. It's an A. It's Spanish is pronounced A. Pampa.
Well, I will say that I've said Cordoba for well over a decade. When I first came here back in 1987, 88, that winter, I probably said it incorrectly. But that one I've said for a long time. But as you know, we have a lot of people doing the weather here. And we also have some commodity traders that talk about the weather, too, in South America. And you're going to have We even have Illinois and Indiana town names butchered by some of them. So I'll do my best, but I do say La Pampa and Cordoba. So
well, it's a my husband is an American. I always make fun of him when he says Spanish words, and he can there's no way he can say them in the Spanish way. So I understand, but those are secondary things.
It's Entre Rios because a lot of people just see entree there, but
so it's entre.
Okay,
entre.
That's one that I've corrected in more recent years since taking a little Spanish. But
Entre Rios, and like when they say Rio Grande is Rio Grande. It's difficult.
That part I may not be good on. Dosul.
But those are secondary things. People do understand what you're talking about, which place you're talking about, and it's great to know that you're doing that job and you're doing it well.
Well, we appreciate the comments. Thank you very much.
All right. We'll continue to work on our Spanish. We have a couple of minutes left. We'll see if we can get at least one more caller, and this is in Avon, Illinois, line number 2. Hello.
Avon, Indiana.
Oh, I'm pardon me, indeed, that's what it says on my screen. It says Indiana, so Jason got it right. Yes, Avon, Indiana, go ahead.
Well, good morning.
Yes.
A couple items. Just listening to Ed, it sounds like meteorology and weather is much like medicine. It's more of an art than it is a science.
I always consider it both.
Okay.
It's a combination.
Two quick questions. The Farmer's Almanac. You know, they always give a prediction, you know, different regions of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Comment on that. And then the other thing, too, is out west and even in parts of Europe, when they give the weather forecast, they break it down to the 1,000-foot elevations. You know, the weather at 5,000, the weather at 6,000, da-da-da-da-da-da. Give me your feedback on that, please.
Okay, I can answer both of those quickly. First, as far as the Farmer's Almanac goes, again, I don't really trust any long-range forecast. But there are some people that want a forecast, even if it's not the most accurate. And I always say, in that case, buy the Farmer's Almanac, because there's a lot of good information in there besides the forecast. And if you want to see what they have to say, it's there, and you're not throwing away a lot of money. There are some people that will charge you tons of money for a long-range forecast. So Farmer's Almanac, to me, is harmless. And, in fact, there's a lot of good information in there. But long-range forecast, I'm not a big fan of. As far as the 1,000-foot level, as you go up in the atmosphere, the temperature drops typically. So that's why a lot of times they're talking about the snow level, the elevation to which snow will fall down to. So sometimes I'll say the snow level is 5,000 feet. That means as you go up a mountain, anything over 5,000 feet in elevation, any place will have snow and so on. So that's why they break down the forecast like that out west.
All right. Just real quick, I want to get with the caller on line 1 because I'm told in Urbana he has the answer to the question about what time it is in Antarctica.
Well, great. I haven't had a chance to look it up yet. What's the answer?
Well, I just read that book about that woman doctor that got rescued.
Oh, yeah. That
down there when she got sick, and she mentions that they're on the time of the supply station in, I think it was Iceland, that comes out to them.
Okay.
Until they get snowbound for the winter, and then they switch to the U.S. station that they interact with. So they just pick their time to be convenient with whoever they're working with. And they switch back and forth between those two. I don't know about other stations, but that's probably how they do it, you know, since there's no obvious cue.
Well, that's very interesting. That's why I didn't answer that question directly, because I wasn't sure what would be picked, and that makes perfect sense to me. Because I recall in the back of my mind reading something about different times down in Antarctica, which is actually a big continent landmass-wise. But well, North Pole, nobody lives there.
We're going to have to leave it at that. I'm sorry we have a couple people we can't take, but maybe once we get into the winter, maybe we could do it again and we could answer some more questions.
Well, this is fun. I appreciated all the calls. The time went quickly.
Thank you very much. Our own meteorologist, Ed Kieser.